You're listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information, visit abc.net.au/conversations. Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. Some people, after living a life a little detached from the religion of their childhood, come back to it in their later years, and they come back with a whole bunch of questions. How can I be useful with the wealth that I've managed to accumulate? How did I come to be in this world anyway? Do I deserve whatever good fortune I've enjoyed? What important business have I left undone? Ron Goldschlager is an Australian philanthropist. He's got a degree in chemical engineering, and he's had a very successful business career. Over the years, Ron Goldschlager has been increasingly absorbed in larger questions, and he's returned to traditional Jewish thought, which relishes such difficult questions. Some years ago, he formed a close friendship with a great rabbi and scholar, Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz of Jerusalem. Together, they've written a book called The Mystery of You, A Journey Through the Paradoxes of Life. Ron Goldschlager, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you, Richard.
Tell me about the Jewish habit of starting in the middle. I'm really interested in the philosophy of starting in the middle.
Well, it's very interesting. I think we Jews are a pretty undisciplined kind of people. I mean, we're individuals and we tend to interrupt each other. So I'm not sure if there's ever a beginning or an end. It seems to always be in the middle.
It's a good place to start the middle sometimes.
I think so. It's actually better to be in the middle of the roader.
So start at the middle, then go to the start and then to the finish or anywhere you like.
I think middle and just sort of move around a bit.
Move around a bit.
Yeah.
Is this reflected in Jewish education, do you think?
I'd say in traditional Jewish education, it's more about inspiring questions. If you can provoke questions and people start having questions, then they find answers, but they have more questions.
You know, that's an idea I always tend to find attractive in that strand of Jewish thought that's like that, that's about questions rather than answers. Yeah. Jesuits are like that in the Catholic Church. They're interested in questions more than the answers. Yeah. There's a strand of Islamic thought that's like that as well, the questions. Why are the questions and not the answers?
Look, I'm not an expert on this. I would say that we, in the Western world in particular, we experience education as being something pumping full of facts, figures, information. And a lot of people might cram and then they forget about it. And if you think about it, the things you really remember are things you've questioned yourself and you found your own answers, probably the best way.
Asking questions, does that keep you away from fundamentalism?
I think fundamentalism is very dangerous in life, in any kind of fundamentalism.
And asking those questions keeps you well away from that?
Possibly. It's my opinion. People are individuals and everyone is different, and that's what's beautiful in society, is the diversity of society and the individuality. And I think as an individual, as you grow and you find who you are, you need to have questions. And the more questions you have and the answers that you find, I think, tend to keep you more in the middle of the road.
Tell me about your garden, Ron.
Excuse me?
Your garden.
Oh, my garden. Well, we're very spoiled. Dina and I, we live in Melbourne, in a beautiful suburb and near the Caulfield Racetrack. And we've got quite a large block of land. And I love water, and we both love nature. So when we did up this house, my wife told me I was allowed one crazy project only, because she knows I'm full of crazy projects. So I've got this beautiful water garden with beautiful fish and plants, and it's like being in paradise. It's like being...
Have you taken a philosophical approach to the garden? Because there's a really interesting whole idea of philosophy behind gardening.
I think in life, I mean, life is about nature. And today, you know, we talk a lot about sustainability. And nature's beautiful. I mean, if you believe in God, God created nature and God created science. And nature's very therapeutic. Even people who are not religious and people who might be stressed in the Western world are advised to go for a walk, enjoy the trees, enjoy the sun. Nature's very therapeutic.
Tell me how philanthropy is part of Jewish tradition. You're a philanthropist and you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, according to Jewish tradition, it's actually Jewish law, we're supposed to give between 10 and 15% of our income to charities. But putting that aside, I think in terms of Jewish values and Jewish life, being charitable and being concerned about others is a very, very important factor. So, I mean, I grew up in my family, and my family were not religious or observant. They were traditional. My family were immigrants from Europe. And I saw how we needed to help other people and have continued with that.
How do you decide who you should give money to, Ron?
That is a very interesting question, Richard, because today there are many, many causes and there are more and more needs. I think once a person starts giving, they tend to give to whoever's asking. And there are many needs, hospitals and various charities, all kinds of needs. And where I am today, I think there's two key factors. One thing which I've observed is in all families who are philanthropic, and you'll see in some of the major Australian families, and seems to be generational, and very often it's lost in the children. So I think a very important factor in a family is, and it's part of education too, is for the parents to share this with the children, to imbue it into the children so there's a continuity. So that's one part. I think today in the Western world, and that's something we're doing more now, one needs to engage. So it's more than just giving money. I mean, giving money can be a feel-good too. And I think one needs to have a look at where's the money going to see that it's being spent wisely, it's not being wasted. I'm not saying to take over the place where you're giving it, but to actually go and visit, to see what's going on, to show an interest, and that will then also help in decision-making in terms of priorities.
Is it wise to give money with strings attached, like this is money for that and you must do this, you must spend it in this way?
Yes and no, more no than yes. I think that giving charity is unconditional. Now, by strings attached, in my opinion, it should not be something that you're looking for benefit for yourself. It's not like, I want this for myself. It's not for you. It's not for me. It's one gives to help other people. Now, in terms of strings attached, if people have a closer look at where it's going, unfortunately, we'll find some places where maybe the money's not being used wisely. So quite often it's worthwhile. It also depends how much one's giving. But if one's giving more of a major contribution or a contribution, say, for a project which might continue over a few years, then one can earmark for that particular project.
You mentioned there about passing the whole idea of philanthropy onto your children. Have you been able to do that with yours?
We are. I mean, our children have got young families and they're growing. But, I mean, we're a very close family and we spend a lot of time together, so the children see what's going on. We don't tend to dictate to our children or to force our children to do anything. We share,
but you've brought them up in a culture of where philanthropy is expected.
Expected is an interesting word. I think it has to come from the heart. It's something which you need to feel and you need to want to do, rather than be forced to do.
So it's a compassion thing rather than an honour thing, then?
Compassion, well, I think a human being needs to have compassion for others. I mean, we need to have compassion not just for human beings but also for animals. We need, in terms of nature today and global warming, we need to have care and feeling for the environment and for the world we live in. I think it's more than compassion. I think it's an obligation. I think it's a responsibility which we have to care for others.
So how do you teach that to kids? How do you teach that idea of philanthropy to children? Just by doing it and letting kids see you do it? Do you say anything to kids while they see you doing it, Ron?
It's a combination. I think it's also how you bring your children up. It has to come naturally. If the children experience it and it's shared, it's like everything you do. It's not forced on them. They're not made to feel like they have to, but they actually see what's going on and they feel part of it. And they see the importance. That's how you have a continuity of values, and that's what parents should be doing to children.
I wonder if you're able to teach your kids the idea of philanthropy, if that's not only an investment in the community or the cause they might help donate to or participate in, it's also investment in the kids themselves, in their emotional well-being.
Very much so. I also feel, Richard, this is something which is probably maybe more of a conscious factor in the Jewish world, if I could put it that way. Because if you look at charities, there are many charities. I mean, we're Australian. I'm Australian. I love my country. And, you know, we have the Children's Hospital. We've got the Mental Society. And as I said, a range of causes. But overwhelmingly, you'll find for the Jewish needs, whether they're Jewish orphans or Jewish problems, old age, all kinds of issues that we have, and our education system, synagogues, we have many things. And generally, non-Jewish people don't give to Jewish things. So Jewish people tend to have to look after Jewish things, but also are looking after non-Jewish or worldly. And then it doesn't come to Jewish, non-Jewish, it's our society.
What do you think about the idea of giving money and labour? And Australians are quite, apparently anyway, are really quite poor at philanthropy generally. We don't really give very much as a nation. We're not big givers to good causes. Maybe we're more prepared to give our time and our labour rather than our money, Ron.
True. It's a question of both. But I mean, to be fair, overwhelming Australians are wonderful people. If you have a look, every time there's a national or a worldwide disaster, whether it was a tsunami, think of the tsunami which took place recently in Haiti with the earthquakes. Australians are very quick to give and to try and help. And, of course, volunteering, if one has the time, whether one volunteers in the soup kitchen or there's various Red Cross things which go on in societies, and there's all kinds of things, op shops, you know, visiting the aged, there's all kinds of things. Australians do give time.
Over the years, you're becoming sort of more interested in Jewish ethical discussions, ethical questions. What does Jewish ethical thought have to say about the rights of the group and the rights of the individual, about how they might interact with each other and often conflict with each other, Ron?
Are you saying now from a religious point of
view? Yeah, or even through a traditional point of view, I suppose, which will be informed by religion and writings and teachings that have happened throughout the millennia.
It has to come down to balance. I mean, in one of my chapters, Belief in Bureaucracy, I saw the tension between the individual and a group. Now, it may not just be in a religious circle, it can be in a sporting club, it can be in anything. But for example, take a person who might attend a church, a Jewish person, a synagogue. I mean, a Muslim would go to a mosque. Various religions have got places where people go together. So you can sort of imagine where a person goes with a feeling, whether it's belief or it's searching or they just need some compassion, they may be searching for some spirituality, and they go to this place. Now, if they don't find what they're looking for in the place, it could be the other people around are involved in something else. Very often people feel switched off or they feel rejected. So I have an analogy about a restaurant. Can I say about the restaurant? Many of us go to restaurants, and there's good and bad restaurants. Now, I've never heard of a person who said, oh, look, I went to that restaurant, food was bad, service was bad, I'm not going to any more restaurants. And yet, you hear a lot of people who are not regular attenders to synagogues, they might go once a year, you know, for the high holidays, or they might go for a bar mitzvah or something, and they'll say, oh, it was terrible, you know, it was noisy, or I didn't like what the rabbi said from the pulpit, or whatever, I'm not going to any more synagogues. So that's what I'm saying. You have to pick and choose. But overwhelmingly, if you look, you'll find.
My guest in conversation at the moment is businessman and philanthropist Ron Goldschlager. His book, written with Rabbi Adin Steinsalt, is called The Mystery of You, A Journey Through the Paradoxes of Life. Tell me your family story, Ron. How did your parents, they were both European Jews, how did they escape the war and the Holocaust?
Well, you could write books on that. My parents actually were born in Vienna in Austria, quite cultured. They didn't know each other in Vienna. Being brief, my mother was on the last child lift out of Vienna through England, and then with her parents, she was reunited with her parents, and they ended up in Argentina, my mother's family. My father was more of a socialist. He was a bit of a naughty boy and didn't like school. And my late grandfather, they had a very successful business actually in Vienna, a very large timber business, and one of the royal family there was the chairman. And I've been to the house. They lived in central Vienna. And when the Nazis came with the Anschluss, the SS officer walked in, threw my grandfather out of his house and his office, and they took it over. So my grandfather was sent to Palestine, which is Israel today, and my father stayed there. And he was a bit of a socialist. He fought with the Nazis on the street, etc. And then later on when it became, and he also helped a lot of people to get papers, because at the time, it's a long story, that's not my book, but at the time, Jewish people found it difficult to get permits to go anywhere. There were long, long lines. So my father, who was quite charming and reasonably good-looking, I think he must have charmed the girls, I think, and he had little papers like passes that he could go back. He didn't have to stand in the line, and he could go back to get a signature somewhere or stamp. So he got a lot of people papers to go out. Anyway, cutting a long story short, he became illegal. He ended up in France, in Marseille. He was working at the market, selling cheeses and whatnot. Long story. And then he ended up on a ship and ended up in Paraguay. And he jumped ship in Paraguay and then found someone to row him down a boat. And there were crocodiles in the Paraná River and ended up in northern Argentina and then came down into Buenos Aires. And there was an organization, a charitable organization called Joint, which he went to a Jewish organization and they found him somewhere to live with a family, and he started working, didn't speak Spanish, he learned Spanish. And then after the war, mum and dad met, well, they weren't mum and dad then, my parents met in Argentina and they got married, and then they immigrated to Australia.
My sort of blood runs momentarily cold when you tell me your dad was a Jewish socialist in Vienna. Wow, he would have been shipped off very, very quickly if he'd stayed. You ever think about that?
Well, you think about a lot of things. I mean, this is, I think, what I'm provoking also the thought in my book. I mean, if people grow up in a liberal Western society like we do in Australia, and you don't have too many things to worry about, so you have your beer and your football and, you know, your mates, life's pretty good. But, I mean, there's a lot more to life. I mean, that's also important, but there's a lot more to life than just that. So when one starts thinking about life and what life is and what could change, and I particularly think, could I say this, please? This is probably one of the big pushes I had in writing, is we have a wonderful country in Australia. It's the best country in the world. But we have to love our country. We have to do something about it. If we just want to take everything for granted, just expect everything, take everything out and not put anything in, God forbid, shouldn't happen what's happened in many other countries before, because the system will collapse. So whether we're charitable, whether we're philanthropic, we have to be caring, but we have to care about people around. We've got to care about our society. And that means we have to have a value system. Can I give an example? And, you know, I travel a lot on business too. And, for example, we have a joint venture in China, in southern China. I'm not saying everything in China is perfect. It's not. It's got a lot of imperfections. But I'll share this. In China, there's no graffiti. You don't see it. You don't see vandalism. Of course, there's wrong things. There's a bit of violence. But there's not public violence. And I once asked, in this is not now China, in Hong Kong, I asked, there's these lovely young girls who work in the hotel and they work late. So I asked them, how do you get home? Like at 1 a.m. Oh, well, we take the train. And then they walk. I mean, I don't tell them to be frightened, but I mean, something can go wrong. But overwhelmingly, the society cares about people. There are a lot of things that we can learn from other societies. You'll notice with East Timor in the book too, there are things we can learn. I think we, in our country, and we're not looking after our country properly. There's so much violence, there's so much dysfunctionality. So I think that's part of what I'm talking about, a value system.
Perhaps so. I don't know. In China, though, a lot of that violence is practiced by the state, though, isn't it? So that's why the fear. When the Berlin Wall was up, there was a lot of graffiti on the western side, but on the eastern side, it was white as snow. I wonder if that was through civic pride or through fear of the authorities at the time.
Right. Well, we'll stay away from politics. But, I mean, in our country, it is so free and everybody is so concerned about their rights. And, of course, we all have rights, but we have to be concerned about responsibilities. We have responsibilities.
Your parents came to Australia. What brought them to Australia? It sounds like things went too bad for them in Buenos Aires. They came here, though.
They came to Australia to start a new life. And my late grandfather had come here, had come to Australia, and my late auntie was already in Australia. Was also very interesting. My father's oldest sister was a very interesting woman. And so they came here to start a new life. That's what they did. They came on a freight ship.
You sort of settled in Elsternwick and Kilda, that part of Melbourne, where a lot of Jewish families came after the war and people who'd survived the Holocaust. Friends remember that time in the post-war years, Jewish friends, who said that there were a lot of Polish Jewish people that survived the Holocaust who came to St Kilda in that area, and it made the place really sad in some sense. The people who found it hard to shake those memories. Do you have those kind of memories of that part of Melbourne after the war, Ron?
I don't, because when my parents set up shop, if you like, they were renting rooms. I mean, and they were also in Hampton. It's more south of Caulfield. It's a beach suburb. And then the first house they built was in East Brighton, where I grew up. My parents' house is still there. At the time, there were market gardens in East Brighton. There's a golf course there. And their friends who lived in Elsternwick, as you say, which is a 10-minute drive, said, we'll never see you. You live so far away. So I actually grew up very much in a non-Jewish area. My early friends, one was from a Catholic family, which I didn't know what it was, explained to me. And one was from a Protestant family, also didn't know what that was, explained to me. We weren't that Jewish. We were European. They were very Australian. That's where I grew up. We used to ride bikes, you know, do naughty things.
Naughty things like what?
Oh, like climb over the fence to the golf course and hide in the tree. And when we saw a golf ball, we used to climb down the tree and take the golf ball, go back up in the tree and watch the people. Those kind of fun, naughty things.
Was Jewish ritual a part of your childhood?
Not so much. My father really wasn't so observant. I mean, he knew that we felt that, you know, we needed to identify. And Mum came from a more observant home. So Mum used to want us to go to the synagogue, say, for the high holidays, the New Year and the Day of Atonement. And then through friends' influence, we went to a Jewish day school, Mount Scopus. I think without that, we wouldn't have had, wouldn't have gone there. I have one, a brother who's 2 years younger than me. So, I mean, for us, the Friday night, it wasn't a religious Friday night, but Friday night was always at home. It wasn't like going out to parties with friends. We had dinner at home. Then later on, as I became more observant, I mean, Mum lit candles, which Jewish people do. Jewish woman lights candles Friday night. And then you make a blessing over the wine. It's called Kiddush. So as I learned this at school, I started doing it. And so gradually we started doing a bit more.
At some point, well, we're all told about this, but I think it has a sting for Jewish children. As they grow up, they hear, they understand the Holocaust has happened. They're told of the Holocaust. What do you remember being of that, having that knowledge? That awful knowledge?
A very interesting question, Richard. I mean, today a lot of people prefer to forget about it. I think within the Jewish world it is a recent memory. I think we have to remember that in Melbourne, also Sydney to some extent in Australia, but in Melbourne was the largest post-Holocaust community in the world outside of Israel. So, I mean, I didn't know a lot about these things growing up. I knew my parents were European, I knew about the German, but my parents had not been to concentration camps, etc. And then as I met friends at school, we might have talked a bit about it. But again, one also has to remember, most Holocaust survivors have terrible nightmares, and really they try to switch it off. There's a phenomenon of trying to close it out. So they didn't talk about it. They didn't want to talk about it. And it was only more as they got older that they realized that the memories would be lost if they didn't talk about it. And it was probably more after university and more growing up, not so much in school. So it was more theoretical, but we talked about it a lot. But we became more aware of it. And then we'd meet like through friends whose parents would be screaming in the night or have nightmares, but the children didn't know what it was because the parents didn't tell them. So what I think I'm trying to say, it's not as though people should understand in a post-Holocaust family, it's not as though it's the main conversation topic, quite the opposite. It's frightening, it's embarrassing, they're shielding their families. And there is actually a group who are the first generation of Holocaust survivors who almost needed self-counseling because they weren't aware of many of these things to understand how they grew up at home, and what they saw at home was very different from what most other people would grow up with.
I suppose the question is about the having that knowledge that at some point I think most of us can understand how you might be, you know, persecuted, if you like, for what you think or what you do. But for who you are and who you are, you could be a group of people could be persecuted en masse like that. It's a shocking thing to understand, isn't it? And that's you too, isn't it? That's you. And the knowledge of that seems to be a really profoundly shocking thing, Ron.
That's true, Richard. I mean, you know, it depends how you want to see it. I mean, people shouldn't grow up, if you like, inverted commas, bearing the cross. One shouldn't grow up feeling guilty and you're carrying the whole world. I mean, I think in the world, Jewish people are very, well, there's not that many Jewish people anyway. And Jewish people are very misunderstood, which is why there's a lot of anti-Semitism in that. So as a Jew, one shouldn't grow up feeling inferior or that. I have to say, I mean, when I grew up with a name like Goldschlager, it was a bit embarrassing because there were Smiths and Browns and Whites, you know, and Mackenzies. And I was Goldschlager. I was a bit embarrassed to say my name aloud. Today in Australia, we're so multicultural. We have so many different names. So maybe today the younger generation is not so embarrassed. But I think there's generally a misunderstanding of what being Jewish is. There's a misunderstanding of what Israel is. And for those people, and there's a lot of course, bad propaganda as well. But, I mean, being Jewish and being Australian, for me, it's not a problem, it's not an issue. I think it's a very beautiful thing.
Growing up, had the war shaken your parents' faith or your father's faith, or did he have a faith to begin with?
They weren't impacted as much. My father's not really a religious kind of a person, and he's not actually a very spiritual kind of a person. He's more of a like, he's got good street sense, if that makes sense. My late mother was more of an intellectual. And, I mean, she grew up more in that typical kind of Germanic European kind of an environment where, you know, it was more authoritarian, and her late father was quite authoritarian. So she grew up in that sort of an environment.
My guest in conversation is philanthropist Ron Goldschlager. You're a scientific kid, mad keen about science, weren't you?
Yeah, strange, isn't it?
Yes. Your first chemistry set?
Yes, I always did. I don't know why, because I always loved chemistry and science. I always made experiments at home. I became a bucket chemist. Used to have a few explosions and fires taking place at home. I actually didn't really do things in a small scale like a test tube. I was more of a wholesaler. I did things on a larger scale.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Philanthropist Ron Goldschlager is my guest in conversation today. He's co-written a book with his friend Rabbi Arden Steinsaltz. It's called The Mystery of You, A Journey Through the Paradoxes of Life. You went to boarding school in Europe as a teenager, Ron. As a young teenager, that must have been a strange experience. Did you experience violence in that boarding school?
I did to some extent. I was 13. It was the first time that my parents were in a position financially, if you like, and also in terms of our family, that they could travel, and they'd never been back to Europe. So they made inquiries, and they weren't quite sure what to do with us two boys, and they discussed in the school. So they felt that overall it was better to take us along, and they found a boarding school to put us in. So we were in a boarding school in the French Swiss for 5 months.
Your family came to Europe to see you, and during that time you took responsibility for the family's Passover. Tell me that how that came to be.
That was interesting because Easter time came and the school, of course, closed. And my parents picked us up in the car. They had been driving around. And we drove to the northern Italian Swiss in a place called Lugano, where there was a Jewish community. And again, my parents didn't know too much about these things in those times. They'd heard there was a kind of a guest house where there were Jewish people and we have the Passover, which is what Jesus was at the Last Supper. That was the Passover. We tell the story of the Exodus of Egypt. So they'd booked in there, and we went the first night, and it wasn't really our scene. I can't explain why. You know, it wasn't the way. We didn't feel that comfortable there. So for the second night, we just decided we'd do it by ourselves in our apartment, which we'd rented. So that was the first time I had to do it on my own.
Was this your idea that you should do it?
Not really. We'd been invited to friends of my parents for Passover, and there's a little book, it's called the Haggadah, which means it's a story and how you tell about the Passover. So we borrowed a few of these books from the guest house, and we had them, and we were reading them and singing the songs and telling the stories.
What happens in Passover for Gentiles who never participated in Passover? How is it celebrated, if that's the word for it, within a Jewish family?
Well, from a religious point of view, we have restrictions. For example, we're not allowed to eat leavened products like bread. We have to eat matzah, which is like a kind of a biscuit. And all of our food products, there's a lot of cleaning. It's like probably that's where the spring cleaning came from, I imagine, because you have to have a massive cleaning. There's a law in the Torah, the five books of Moses, which says that leavened will not even be found within your borders. You're not allowed to possess it. It's very strict. It's probably one of the strictest laws. So there's a tremendous amount of cleaning. You see, there's no crumbs in pockets, and we have different, those who keep probably different dishes and different everything. It's all changed. Anyway, so you come to Passover night, and everyone comes together, and it's in two parts. The meal's in the middle. And the first part, there's stories and songs, and tell the story about the Exodus of Egypt, which I can tell you more about if you wanted to know. It's in the Bible in the second book, Exodus. One can read about it. And then we move into some more of these sort of stories and a few other songs. There's a lot of discussions. One of the discussions is about the four sons. Comes out of nowhere. It appears to be irrelevant. Suddenly there's a discussion of the four sons. There's the clever one. There's the so-called bad one or the wicked one. There's the simple one and the one who doesn't know how to answer questions. Now, we could spend hours just on that topic, because there's a lot of philosophy in this. Is it all within one person? Is this the basis of a group of people and nature of people? One of the most beautiful parts is when the youngest child asks the four questions called Manishtana, which means what is different. And they sing a song. It goes like this. Ma nishtana halayla hazeh. That's Hebrew. And it means, what's different on this night? And then, and some of the differences, like, we drink 4 cups of wine. And why we only have matzah, this unleavened bread, and not normal bread. And why do we have bitter herbs? And why do we have salt water? These kinds of questions. And then we have answers to the questions. So again, it's a Jewish thing. We involve the children, especially the young children. And the more the young children are involved with questions, what I said before, and answers, and making it fun. And this is how you learn. These are the experiences.
And this is followed by the Seder. Is that right?
That's called the Seder. Seder in Hebrew, Seder, means order. Order. You'll notice in my book, when our editor, Yehudit, said in the beginning she couldn't do the editing, she said, this was in Jerusalem, she said, Lo mesuda, it's not in order, my writing. She said, it's a mess, this Ron Goldschlager, we can't do it, it's not orderly. Well, Seder means order, it's an order of a service.
So after high school, you won a scholarship, you studied chemical engineering, and you were working in that area for a while. How did you end up working in the family business?
I don't really know. I mean, I used to go in always on holidays. We had a timber yard. Used to stack timber and pull timber out of the machines. And then we had a bit of retail. Used to help to serve and, you know, load and unload the truck. Always did this on holidays. I loved my chemical engineering. I was very, very, very lucky, I would say, that I went into responsible positions very early. I mean, I was already Queen Scout at school. I always felt responsible. So I'd hardly left university, and I was already in quite a senior managerial position. So I never thought I'd want to be out of that. I was working in public companies. And then I was in a sort of a transition. And I went in to help with something. I don't remember. Then Dad asked me, and I came in for a day or two, and then that sort of became a week and then became a month. And all of a sudden, I found that I sort of, I suppose, in some ways fell in love with the business, and I was happy to be in business.
Talking to Ian McFarlane on the program earlier, who worked for his dad for a while, there's an old saying in the country, when you work on your dad's farm, it's a bit of a bugger working for dad. Is it difficult working for your father?
Of course. It depends. It depends about the attitude. You know, with my dad being European and fairly dogmatic, of course we had differences of opinion and arguments and conflicts. That's normal.
And you're religiously observant. Did he ever tease you about that?
He didn't tease me, but he sure told me about it, because I remember when we shifted from near Mum and Dad in East Brighton, we shifted to Caulfield, which was for the children, was closer to the school, and we started keeping Sabbath, and we were always together. My parents used to come for Sabbath anyway, and I remember my father saying to me, oh, all the things I'm missing out on in life, keeping this Sabbath. And I laughed and I said to him, look what we've got. Look what we've got, having one day when we don't drive the car, we don't turn on the radio or the TV, my mobile phone is switched off, we walk, we talk, we're sitting together with the children, with the family. Look at what I have. Don't have a look at what I don't have. It's one day of a week, which is so special.
Has this got you thinking about, there's a large part in your book about this, about the story of Genesis and the creation of the world and why God rested on the seventh. Tell me about that, what your thinking was on that.
Well, this is probably when I started writing, because it's chapter 7 now, but it's when I started, and at that time I didn't know, Richard, that I was writing a book. That was 12 years ago now. It took 10 years to write this. And it started that, as you mentioned, I had a real love for science, and I believed in science, and I believed in what I saw. And then I also had, I don't know why, I also had a love for Torah and for Judaism. For some reason I believed in God. I can't say why. That's a very personal thing. I feel actually I was lucky having that. I feel, I'll come to your question. I feel that if a person has that belief, it's a much easier way to live, and it's lucky if you do something about it than a person who doesn't. But I think we'll come to that. And then as I was very questioning, and I am questioning, I found apparent conflicts. And what you mentioned is one. If you read creation in Genesis, again, my Hebrew is not terrific, but it's a working Hebrew. It's different when you read the Bible in the original language and with the interpretations. I think I have to make that point, rather than in translation. The English translation is very loose and in a lot of cases inaccurate. But coming to the English, we have the 6 days of creation, and on the seventh day it says God rested. He rested. And in the Jewish calendar, we're in round figures in the year 5700, which they say is after creation. Fine. And I had a problem, because I believed in the Torah and I believe in the 5700, but I also believe that there are things which are millions of years old, and we know about dinosaurs, and we know about things which are billions of years old. I believed in both. So that's where the search started. I didn't want one to be true and the other one not to be true. I wanted to find how both can be true together.
They can't, can they?
Of course they can.
How?
How? It's in my book, chapters.
How can they be true
well,
together?
Well, this is a hard concept to explain quickly on the radio like this. And you really need to...
We've got time.
Thank you. Well, to explain this difference in time, you really need to have an understanding of Einstein's theory of special relativity. And Einstein explains that time is relative. It's relative to speed and relative to distance. So again, exaggerating, I need to exaggerate. If one sees the first 6 days of creation, if you read the Bible, man didn't exist. Man was created on the eve of the Sabbath. At the end of the sixth day, it's before the seventh day. So in the first 6 days, there's no man. So you've actually got God telling the story of what happened after creation of man. Then you've got man telling the story as he experienced it. And there we need to understand relativity, because you can have a situation which is really one day, such as if you're in a spaceship somewhere. It's hard to understand. If you're in a spaceship and you were flying at somewhere in space at very high speed.
Close to the speed of light, then
close
time
to
changes.
The speed of
yes.
light. Yes, so for you have one day. Someone else watching that can be a billion years.
God stands outside of time, in other words.
God is timeless. He's timeless.
Does it need even to be literally true? Why not just enjoy those stories from Genesis as beautiful metaphors? You know, the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden. It's a bit like, you know, humans being expelled from the womb, if you like, and they have to then exist out into the world. It's a lovely metaphor if you think about it like that. Why not? Isn't that good enough that they're just beautiful metaphors?
I agree with that. And, you know, in Judaism, we have what's called the written law, which is the Bible, the Torah. And we have the oral law, which is the Talmud, which Rabbi Steinsaltz, that is a lifelong work. Rabbi Steinsaltz has done his own translation of the Talmud, which is just finished. And if you like, it's like being in a lecture. You have the lecturer talking and you have the lecture notes. So the literal Bible is like the lecture notes. But the oral law, the explanation is what goes with it. And you can't really have one without the other. They have to go together.
Just as you and your wife, Dina, defined your own family's traditions, have you had conflict or challenge from your own kids?
No. We're very close. We have four children, and they're all married. And right now, three of the families have children. We're blessed with 10 wonderful grandchildren. We sort of never left school, because when our baby finished, she's not a baby anymore, when she finished year 12, our first grandchild started kindergarten. We don't have conflict. Now, our children are very alike, but they're also very different. And some of them have the same degree of observance as we do. And some of them are less observant. And some of them are more observant. And yet there's no conflicts.
You were talking just tangentially before about Shabbat and how that works. I've been to Shabbat twice, once in Israel, once in Melbourne. And it's great. It's really lovely. A family that can be arguing, carrying on, and being like families are, suddenly fall into this pattern where everyone has a thing to say or do, and a squabbling family can suddenly become quite graceful in the actual... Take me through the process of Shabbat and what happens, and whether Gentiles can attend Shabbat.
Of course. It should be very, very nice if non-Jewish people befriend, or Jewish people befriend, they befriend each other and they get invited. It's like having a dinner together. I mean, from a religious point of view, and Shabbat starts at sunset on Friday night, wherever you are in the world. And it finishes at darkness on Saturday night. So if the sky's clear, darkness is defined by three visible stars. And now, once Shabbat starts, there are restrictions in what you can and can't do. In fact, there's books being written. There's a whole Talmud, a whole large chapter in the Talmud which tells you down to the minutiae of what you can and can't do. But I mean, fundamentally speaking, on Shabbat it's a different day, it's a differentiation. And when the way I like to explain it possibly is, when Shabbat finishes, we have a beautiful little prayer, it's called Havdalah. It's a differentiation. In fact, in the creation, and God also separates and he differentiates between light and darkness. If you remember, he separates the light out of the darkness. It's the same word, same root of the word, lehavdil, mavdil, havdalah. And havdalah is the separation between the Shabbat and the rest of the week. Like you had the creation of the seventh day and the other 6 days. So the seventh day, the so-called day of rest, and the 6 days of creation or of work. So Shabbat is a very beautiful period of time. And if one is traditional, one goes to synagogue, especially the men. In the Jewish law, women are allowed to do religious things. Of course they do, but they're not bound by time-related laws. Because a woman, it's understood, you know, she's busy with children, with other things. So a woman does not have to go to synagogue on most cases. She can if she wants to, but a man should. So Friday evening, the men will generally go to synagogue, and then they come home, and then the family's there. You know, they might take the children, depends on the ages. You might have friends invited, family, parents. We're generally close. And then you make the blessing on the wine, or the women, of course, have lit candles, I should say, just before sunset, just before it starts. We can't make fire. We can't light things or switch switches on and off of electricity. So you do those things. Like, we don't cook on Sabbath. The food's prepared beforehand. You can have a time clock to heat it up if you want, which comes on and off, but we don't switch things on and off if one's doing it properly.
I did that for the family when I stayed with them. Put the lights on for them. They didn't urge me to.
You were the light switcher.
I was the Shabbos goy. I knew about this, and they didn't ask me because it's not nice. It's not proper to ask. But I said, "Would you like me to do this?" They said, "Oh, you can or you can't. It might be nice, you know. Sure, if you want to do
it's
that."
It's like when the light seems to be off in the toilet and somehow miraculously comes on again. Those kinds of things, don't we know?
So in the year 2000, you celebrated Shabbat on your own at East Timor. Tell me how you got there and how you actually managed to celebrate Shabbat. There.
Well, East Timor was very interesting. I got this, one of my crazy, as I say, for these crazy projects, this crazy passion in me. At the end of 99, I sort of became more aware of East Timor, and I met some representatives of the Timor Freedom Movement, if you like. I'm a non-political person, I have to keep stressing that. And I don't know, I just felt sorry for them. I wanted to try and help. And maybe in many ways I saw a parallel of what you said before, Richard, between what Jewish people suffered in persecutions, particularly in the Holocaust, because this was a genocide what took place in East Timor. So I became very involved with them, and then used to meet with them every day and find out. And then I got an invitation from Shanana Gusmao to come to East Timor. But, I mean, civilians didn't go at that stage, so it was all organized. I went there in February of 2000, and to be able to function there, another one of my crazy projects, I got the East Timorese people, I sent them some money, and they were in Darwin. They bought a second-hand four-wheel drive, and the Australian Navy had the Fast Cat, which used to go across to supply, so they took it over for us, so we actually had transport. And I spent about 10 days then, and I discussed with them a model. What also attracted me to it is that they were going to be the first new country of the millennium, and they wanted to build a country with no corruption and no exploitation. That really appealed to me. So I discussed with them, I built them a model of how they could start with small businesses and small different things to build up with their culture. So while I was there, of course, it would be Shabbat. Now, Timor is basically a Catholic country. I mean, it's tribal, but Catholic. And so they didn't know anything about Judaism. So I explained to them that I could do whatever they wanted. I mean, of course, I've got restrictions with my food, but I keep kosher, which I can explain. And so I said, but what I need to do is wherever we're going to be on Friday night, I said, please, we're going to sleep. I mean, I need to try and get there 2 hours before sunset, because I was worried if they were a bit late or something went wrong, I didn't have time to get myself organized. 2 hours before sunset. I said, then I can't drive. I can walk, we can talk, I have to stay there. And then on Saturday night, when it's dark, back to normal, whatever we're doing. So we were in a place in the eastern part of East Timor, Bacau it's called, it's the second largest part. And we lived in a broken house, which must have been like from the Portuguese colonial times. And it was very beautiful, it was very special.
Ron Goldschlager is here today, businessman, philanthropist. He's co-written a book with Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz called The Mystery of You, A Journey Through the Paradoxes of Life. Tell me how you became friends with this rabbi. This rabbi is quite a really senior rabbi. He's a very senior, hugely respected rabbi. He's based in Jerusalem. His opinions are sort of all over the world. Tell me how you became friends with this rabbi.
was interesting. This is not a rabbi who's like a pulpit rabbi or rabbi in a community. He's a, if you can be more, a genius is a genius, but I don't know if you can be a super, he's a super genius. He's self-taught, and he's not just in religious things. He loves animals, mathematics, physics, chemistry, literature, you name it. He's got a computer memory. And I heard a lecture of his. This was back at around the time I had this conflict with science and religion. He was talking, and I just found it fascinating. This was during my search, which I mentioned. So I went up to him. In there's a Yiddish word called chutzpah. It means to be cheeky.
Audacity.
Audacity. That's it. I got chutzpah. So I went up to him to ask him a question, and I liked the way the answer was. And then I sort of stayed in touch with him, and then I met him again some time later. And I said to him, look, I'm writing this and this. Can I? By that time, I was sort of through the first draft of my science and religion. So I gave it to him. And I said, do you think you'd like to do this with me? We'll do a book. And I think he looked at me with a twinkle in his eye and said, why not?
What is the function of rabbis in the Jewish community? It's different from priests.
Rabbi's not a priest. A rabbi's a teacher. A rabbi's a teacher. In the Jewish religion, we don't have, if you like, an intermediary. I mean, I understand a bit about Christianity. In Christianity, you sort of have a middleman, particularly in Catholicism, where you people go to make confession or they see the priest between themselves and whether in Catholicism the Pope or in other denominations and God. And in Judaism, each person's responsible directly to God. You can talk to God yourself. You're accountable to God. There's no middleman, if you like. A rabbi's a teacher. Now, there are various roles of rabbis. And in, say, one or two centuries ago, rabbis are generally pretty smart. They're well-read. They're learned. And if you think about it, especially in Eastern Europe and other communities, a century ago, people weren't so learned. People had to make a profession. So the rabbi was generally the most learned. Today you have a lot of lay people who are just as learned or more. So a rabbi has multiple roles today in a community. He can give advice to people if they need religious advice, in teaching, in a community where you need to have food supervision for the kosher, the kashrut. Some rabbis specialize in this. Rabbis will do marriages. They give counseling to people, a multitude of things.
They console as well.
Console, yes.
This rabbi consoled you after your mother died. Tell me what he told you about parents.
Rabbi Steiner said one of the most beautiful things to me. I probably start crying when I mention this. And I think this is probably the key thing we should all think about what I was trying to say before in the Western world. It was the first night in Jewish religion when you lose a parent, you sit Shiva, again seven. That number, 7 days, you stayed home, and you're in mourning. There's a year of mourning for a parent, but those first 7 days are very strict.
Is there a ritual where you sleep on the floor? Or is that an old? It's a cultural thing rather than a Jewish thing.
You don't. Sure. You're less comfortable. You can sleep in a bed, but you don't wear leather shoes. There's a whole set of rules and regulations. You generally don't wash as much. I mean, you shouldn't be unclean, but you're in mourning. There's a whole process of mourning. And people generally come to your home. They bring food to your home. They come to your home for the religious services. Sabbath excluded. Sabbath, you go to the synagogue, but otherwise you're at home. So the rabbi had been traveling. He was in Jerusalem. They'd been trying to phone me because we were very good friends by then. And also he'd lost his mother-in-law a few months earlier when I'd phoned him. And this is what he said to me. He said, you know, there's no way you can ever repay a parent for what they've done for you. And we all know there are many conflicts and issues that we have about our parents. The rabbi said, there's no way you can ever repay your parents for what they've done for you. He said, the only thing you can try and do is to be a better parent to your children than your parents were for us. Can I comment on that? And it's true, because Dina and I, we love our parents, but we try to be better parents, if there's such a word, inverted commas, better. But I'd like to talk about this in a different way.
So just first of all, did that bring you some peace, that what he said to you then? Did that help? Well, I don't know if help's the right word I'm looking for, but did that...
Consolation.
Did that give you consolation?
It wasn't consolation. It's hard to explain to another person. When you have that kind of an intellectual friend, you know, he's a very special human being. And he takes the time and he wants to talk to you, and he talks from the heart softly and talks like that. It has a major impact. It's not so much consolation. It has a major impact, and it's beautiful what he said. Because if you think about it today, an analogy is there's so much crime, there's so much dysfunctionality in our own society, and we hear about poor so-and-so, you know, they had a bad childhood, all these bad things were done for them, poor so-and-so. Well, of course we feel sorry for so-and-so, but it doesn't give them the right to go and do this to other people. It doesn't. And like the rabbi said, we have to try to be better parents. So nobody should give an excuse that because they were badly treated, it gives them a right to treat other people badly. Quite the opposite. They should realize that how they felt, and they should try to treat other people better.
Just finally, Ron, I've only left moments for this, about not even a minute to do this. Do you have an expectation of an afterlife?
I believe in an afterlife because I believe the soul is separate from the body.
Is that accord with Jewish tradition, Jewish thinking on it?
Of course it's part of Jewish thinking. I mean, it's also very Kabbalistic, which is spiritual, to go into the details.
Fantastic to meet you, Ron. Great to have you here to talk about these things. It's been kind of a different conversation, and I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you very much, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.